Full honest with y'all, I didn't get to pick this passage. As many of y'all know, we're studying the book of Philippians, and it was what was assigned because we were having a youth devo, and so we're like, well, let's just get the teens involved in the service somewhere. And so, well, what passage fell on September 24th? And Rob told me it was Philippians 1, 27 through 30. So unlike everyone else who got to pick their passage in Philippians, I got stuck with this one. And I'll be honest, I wasn't terribly excited. I mean, it's not one of the better passages at first thought in Philippians. It's not the to live is Christ and to die is gain passage that y'all, I missed that by 1 week. It's not the one where y'all probably look at next week where it's the Christ hymn who, your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being of very nature God did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing. It's not a passage like that. It's not even like in Philippians 4, where it says, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure. I didn't get those. I got Philippians 1, 27 through 30. So I was looking at it, and I read it. And I read it again, and again, and again, and again. And the more I read it, the more I fell in love with it, and the more excited I got about it. These four short verses are extremely profound and deep. And as I read and studied, the more I learned and the more I grew. So tonight, I just want to share a little bit about what I've learned about this passage and what it may mean for us who are a part of a church community in the American 21st century. So let's get into the text. I'm going to have some teens read throughout the sermon. So the first is Philippians 1, 27 through 30. You don't have to stand.
Know that you stand firm in the one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer. Since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have.
Great. Thank you, Israel. So I can't really talk about this passage without talking about how it fits into the bigger part of the letter. These four verses serve really as a transition from a theme of suffering to a theme of unity. And just before this, as y'all looked at last week, Paul shares the suffering he was enduring at the time. And now he turns his attention to the church's suffering, and how they need to remain united all the more. Now, unity is a major theme in the book of Philippians, if you haven't noticed that. As we'll see later on in the study, two prominent members of the church, Euodia and Syntyche, were quarreling with one another, and their dispute more than likely spread to the rest of the congregation. So that's why he urges them to stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith in the gospel. And then just after this passage, moving into chapter 2, he focuses on putting the interest of other people ahead of their own and to follow the example of Christ's humility. And that probably is answering a little bit more about what it means to conduct yourselves worthy in the manner of Christ, which we're going to look at in a minute. So as I hope you can see, there's a natural transition going on here that makes these four verses extremely important in Paul's overall argument. So let's get back to our text. Paul writes, whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. The Greek word he uses for that word conduct yourself is a pretty unique one in the New Testament. In fact, it's a word that's only used twice in the entire New Testament. The other instance occurs in Acts chapter 23, verse 1, where if you recall, Paul addresses the Jewish chief priests in Sanhedrin. He was arrested by the Roman soldiers over the claim that he had defiled the temple. And Paul responds to the accusation by saying, starting in verse 1, he says, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to the day." That word translated as duty is the same word translated in Philippians here as conduct. Now, there's a similar word with the same root found later in Philippians chapter 3, verse 20, where Paul says that our citizenship is in heaven. The citizenship is the key word there. So what Paul is essentially telling the church in Philippi is that they ought to live their lives as citizens of the kingdom of heaven rather than as citizens of the Roman Empire. Now, this is a huge deal because Philippi was an extremely patriotic city in the Roman Empire. The people who lived in Philippi were very proud of their city and their status of being a Roman citizen. The people who lived there were proud. It was a very popular city for Rome's military veterans to live in. So a lot of the veterans would come home from war and they'd retire and they'd live in Philippi. It was a major city. It was pretty easy to see why Paul would go to Philippi to start a church, because it was so central to the nervous system of Rome. And so, but it's safe to say the Philippians were extremely patriotic Roman citizens. So Paul carefully chooses that word to appeal to their pride as Roman citizens and to extend it to their new and more important citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, they are to live their lives according to the gospel of Christ rather than to the society around them. If they were successful in that endeavor, though, they would invite suffering on themselves because they no longer fit into the rest of society as a whole, which is why Paul stressed that they must present a united front against their opposition. He says, again, stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith in the gospel without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. In the face of opposition, it's natural to be scared, frightened. But Paul says, don't be frightened. And he gives them two reasons why they should not be frightened for conducting themselves in a manner worthy of Christ. The first reason is that because this opposition is a sign to them that in the day of Christ, their opponents will be destroyed. At some point in the future, in the end, at the judgment day, whatever it is, their opponents will get what they deserve. Second, their suffering is a sign of their salvation. What Paul understands and what he's trying to get the church to understand also is that the battle has already been won. Jesus Christ is the King and the true Lord of the world. And if they claim to follow the true leader of the world, then it's all the more important that their actions align with their beliefs. Their public behavior must match up to the gospel as they seek to live above reproach. It's the same idea that Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11 and 12. And Giles got that for us.
Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us.
Thank you, Gael. So whether opposition and suffering comes or not, disciples of Jesus Christ must always live in a way that honors Christ. And more times than not, it goes against the cultural norms and in some cases even human nature. This suffering comes from living a life worthy of the gospel of Christ. It's a gift that is given to all believers because it connects us with the sufferings of Christ himself. Paul says in our passage here, it says, it has been granted, it has been graced, it has been gifted to you, suffering has, on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now here I still have. Suffering connects us with Christ. He writes even more about this in verse Hayden's going to read to us right now from Philippians 3, verse 10.
I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings. Become like him in death.
Thank you. No. Thank you. I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship and the sharing and the participation of sharing in his suffering. as disciples of Jesus who seek to become like him, what better way than to share in his sufferings? Paul writes these words not as a discouragement, but as encouragement to them to stand fast, because it really means that they're doing something right. If they are getting, if they're suffering and being persecuted because of they were living their lives according to the gospel, then that means they are doing something right. That's what Jesus said. Don't love the world. If the world hates you, just know they hated me first. If you are suffering as a Christian, you are doing something right. If we suffer for the sake of the gospel of Christ, we align ourselves with Jesus and are shaped all the more into his image. Now, this suffering is not what many Western American Christians may think. It's the kind of suffering that comes to a small group of believers who are surrounded by and living in a hostile and unbelieving environment. Yet that is something I believe we can relate to in the midst of living in this hostile and unbelieving community. Early Christians were able to do that. I think we can too. Today in our society, in 21st century America, it seems the church is being pushed more and more to the margins of society. If the pattern continues as it has, churches will become smaller and smaller. Honestly, quite a few will close their doors, if not already. It's said that the European Christian Christians in Europe are about 20 years ahead of where we are now. And if that's a foreshadowing things to come, Christianity is going to just keep declining. That's a state of what we're living in right now. And as a whole, America has moved into what many are calling a post-Christian society, where Christianity is no longer the dominant religion or influence in our country. I heard a stat, though I can't back it up, but 49% of America are practicing Christians. I think that's about right. Less than half now. Less than half. I believe we've all seen this to some extent, and I'm sure many are lamenting that the church has lost its place in our country. But I want to say that I believe what's happening, though, is a good thing. Yes, the church is being pushed into the margins, but it's in the margins that historically the most growth has happened in the church. This isn't a time for the church to be extinct. This is a time for the church to grow and thrive. It may not be an astronomical numerical growth. It could be the growth that we see is more spiritual growth of the disciples, where those who remain faithful in the church live as these radical disciples who are fully 100% engaged in their walk with Christ. But when the church remains faithful to her bride in the face of public opposition, people will take notice. They will, and ask questions. At least that's, you know, what happened in the first 300 years of Christianity, when it was sporadically persecuted by the Roman Empire. In that time, the church was definitely in the margins of society, and early Christians had to learn how to live and interact in a world that they knew was not of their own. So how did they do that? In the year 130 AD, someone wrote an epistle or a letter to a man named Diognetus. While we don't know who wrote it, we do have in writing what was expected of Christians in the early church community. I have it behind me, so follow along as I read. In this letter, we read this: "For the Christians are distinguished from other men neither by country nor language nor the customs which they observe. For they neither inhabit cities of their own, nor employ a peculiar form of speech, nor lead a life which is marked out by any singularity. The course of conduct which they follow has not been devised by any speculation or deliberation of inquisitive men, nor do they, like some, proclaim themselves the advocates of any merely human doctrines, but inhabiting Greek as well as barbarian cities, according as the lot of each of them has determined, and following the customs of the natives in respect to clothing, food, and the rest of their ordinary conduct, they display to us their wonderful and confessedly striking method of life." And this next section is really what I'm getting at. They dwell in their own countries, but simply as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others and yet endure all things as if foreigners. Every foreign land is to them as their native country, and every land of their birth as a land of strangers. They marry, as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws and at the same time surpass the laws by their lives. They love all men and are persecuted by all. They are unknown and condemned. They are put to death and restored to life. They are poor, yet make many rich. They are in lack of all things and yet abound in all. They are dishonored, and yet in their very dishonor are glorified. They are evil spoken of, and yet are justified. They are reviled and blessed. They are insulted and repay the insult with honor. They do good, yet are punished as evildoers. When punished, they rejoice as if quickened to life. They are assailed by the Jews as foreigners and are persecuted by the Greeks. Yet those who hate them are unable to assign any reason for their hatred. To sum it all up in one word, what the soul is to the body, that are Christians in the world. The early Christians understood their place in this world as sojourners, as aliens, as strangers, and their lives aligned with the values of their true home in the kingdom of heaven. The early church lived in an openly hostile environment. Yet look what they did. When they were insulted, they repaid that insult with honor. When they made themselves poor to make other people rich. They loved everybody, but were persecuted by everybody. It's an incredible way to live. The church, the early Christians, they knew how to conduct themselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Because in that first 300 years of Christianity, it grew and grew and grew. All their lives were all the evidence they needed for their faith. Can't we do the same? I think it's time for Christians to worry about our own conduct rather than the conduct of a temporary earthly nation. Stop worrying and complaining about the direction our country is going. Let God take care of that. Rather, what you and I are called to do is that whatever happens, whatever our country decides, whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. I cannot control what our country does. I can't control what other countries do. What I can control is my life, how I live, how I act, how I behave in a world that is increasingly becoming more hostile towards what I believe. In writing about this passage in Philippians, Karl Barth, a theologian, says this: Christians do not strive against anybody, nor for anybody either. Rather, Christians strive for the faith. The Christian way is to refuse retaliation and to live such exemplary lives that our persecutors not only become ashamed of their conduct, but want to become believers themselves. Some of you may have heard this. There was a shooting today at the Burnett Chapel Church of Christ in Antioch, Tennessee. A 25-year-old man walked to the building, shot and killed a woman, and continued inside to shoot and injure six more people before an usher jumped in, confronted the man, and in the struggle, the shooter accidentally shot himself. How should Christians respond towards such hatred towards them? I'll try to answer this question as I close with the words from Jesus in Luke chapter 6. Starting in verse 27, Jesus says, "But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If there's anyone here tonight who needs a prayer in this church, we offer this time for you to come forward. If you'd like to put Christ on in baptism and dedicate your life as his disciple and enter into the good news of Jesus Christ, we offer that this time as well. If you have any other needs, you can come forward as we stand and sing.